So in this study and the study next month, we're going to talk about Balaam. You may think, well, how can you talk about Balaam twice? Well, actually, there's enough to talk about him this time, and then there are some other things that we can talk about next time. To begin with, if you look at the bottom line, Balaam was an evil man. As you look at the research about that particular individual, it tells us that he was quite an intriguing character. A major reason why he was an intriguing character is this, is God was involved with him. God was involved with him. God spoke to him personally. He met him on the road and spoke, and when he was on his way to curse Israel, just like he confronted Paul on the road to Damascus. God inspired Balaam by his spirit, and he entrusted Balaam with prophecies about his children, Israel, and about some of the surrounding nations. And if you look in Numbers chapter 24, he prophesies about the Messiah. So those are all interesting things, but again, Balaam was an evil man. And he was an evil man who was able to figure out a way to bring a curse on Israel without personally pronouncing a curse on them. He found a way, a loophole, that allowed for Israel to be cursed. We might ask, why would this evil man be important to all of us? Well, in the study today, I'd like to examine Balaam, and I think that you'll see some examples that apply to us now, and I think you'll see some parallels between our time and the time of the story. So the title of my presentation is Balaam, so keeping it simple here. So let's set the stage for this particular subject by looking at Numbers chapter 22. Numbers chapter 22 sets the stage for what we're going to talk about today. And Numbers 22, the focus is Israel. Focus is Israel. Numbers chapter 22, verse 1. It says, "Then the children of Israel moved and camped in the plains of Moab on the side of the Jordan across from Jericho." So Israel came to the plains of Moab. They're across the river Jordan from Jericho. And they had come to this point after wandering for 40 years in the wilderness. Their wanderings are coming to a close. They've spent 40 years after coming out of Egypt, wandering from camp to camp. Sometimes they were at a camp for a long time. Sometimes they were there for a day. It just depended. Going around and around, and sometimes coming back to a particular place they've already been, and then moving forward again. But the ultimate destination from the time that they left Egypt throughout that 40-year period was the land of promise. And in verse 1, we see that Israel is ready to cross the Jordan and begin the conquest of the land of Canaan. Now, let's go back to turn back one chapter to Numbers 21, because this immediately precedes what we're looking at in chapter 22. So this first slide focuses on Arad, which is right here. And the people of Israel had gone from down here at the bottom, Kadesh Barnea, and they had begun moving north, and the king of Arad, a Canaanite king, he knew they were coming, and so he gathered up his army and he came out to battle the Israelites. And he was soundly defeated. And so they defeated him, Israel defeated him, and they moved on from there. The place where they defeated them was called Hormah, which is right here. And then they began to move away from there. Interestingly, as you look at what takes place here, they're actually going to go, they defeated him, and then they're going to basically go in this direction and go on up to the plains of Moab, which we'll look at in the next slide. So the Numbers chapter 21 discusses this defeat. And then the people of Israel became very discouraged because God told them not to... that's not the one I want. God told them as they left this area where they had defeated Arad, He told them to go down here around the Dead Sea and to not go in this area of Edom or Moab. So they weren't to travel through those areas. They were to stay away from them and not mess with them. And as they get out here where they're traveling, they're in the wilderness. And it's a pretty desolate place, and they became quite unhappy about it and complained about it. And so God sent the fiery serpents in to kill various individuals who were not who were complaining, and so a number of them were, thousands of them were killed. And the bronze serpent was set up, which sadly later on had become a god for the people of Israel. Now the children of Israel moved on, and they went around Moab. Here's Edom. They came down, they went around them, and they went all the way around here. And up here, we find the plains of Moab right here. So this is the plains of Moab. They come up here. And there are better maps, even a color map, but I couldn't get those maps to duplicate for all the effort that I put into it. So we're going black and white. But anyway, they came up, and as they came up to the land, they sent messengers to two kings that ruled up in this area, Og and Sihon. And the king Sihon was the king of the Amorites, and Og was the king of Bashan. And both of them, they said, "There's no reason for us to fight. We're not going to take your grain, your cattle, your territory. We're moving through. And we're going to cross the river Jordan and conquer the land." However, they didn't buy that. And they came out and they sought to defeat Israel and turn Israel back. And Israel defeated both of them soundly. The description in the scriptures, they just wiped out both of those nations. And as a result of their being wiped out, that land became the land of Israel. It belonged to Israel from that point onward. So you had some Israelites that dwelt on to the east of the Jordan, and some of them that dwelled to the majority of them dwelled to the west of the Jordan. But that area up there where the Amorites are, this area here, it became part of Israel. Manasseh, the half-tribe of Manasseh, they received part of that land, the land of Gilead, and Bashan became their land as they defeated those other nations. So then they come up to the right to the northern border of, you see here it says Moab, and they came to the plains of Moab, and they're right at the top of the area there where right at the northern border of Moab. And they see the defeat of these two great kingdoms, and you have to realize that the Moabites were under the domination of the Amorites. They dominated them, and by Israel defeating Og and Sihon, they were free. They were free now. So they were grateful, of course, weren't they? Not at all. They weren't grateful at all. In fact, they were frightened. Here, this huge nation, you have to realize, is somewhere between 2 and 3 million people. So it's like the city of Houston moving in to your northern border. You would probably be disturbed. I mean, let's look at the fact of what's taking place in Europe. They're being invaded basically by thousands of people fleeing the Middle East. And it's creating an upheaval in Europe And we're having the same place take place in our country with basically an invasion of thousands of people, which is creating an upheaval. So if you had 2 or 3 million people come to your border, you're going to be unhappy about it. And they were quite unhappy. You had 2 to 3 million people plus livestock. And you have to realize they didn't all move along at once. You know, you had some that began and others started much later. And so if you had a point along the trail that you passed, the people, the last people in the procession here, they're going to come by a lot later. But the people of Moab were, their population was probably about the same size as the children of Israel. And they were watching all these people come to their northern border. And they were quite concerned. And seeing these two great kings that had dominated them fall to these people, they were frightened. They were frightened. And as the Israelites went through their wilderness wanderings, coming up into this territory, God had told them, don't mess with Edom, as I said, down here south of the Dead Sea, nor Moab, just to the east of the Dead Sea. Don't mess with those people because they are relatives. Don't mess with them, go around them. And while they were camped across from Jericho, Moses wrote the book of Deuteronomy. He wrote all 32 chapters, and there are parts of the book of Deuteronomy that talk about his death. He did not come back posthumously to write those. Somebody else wrote them. But he wrote all 32 chapters there as they are on the brink of entering into the land of promise. Moses also went up to Mount Nebo to see into the promised land. And here's Mount Nebo. You have the mountain here, and you have the top of Pisgah. And from Mount Nebo, Moses could see into the land of promise. God said, because of his sin against God, by his hitting the rock with the staff, he said, you're not going into the land. You aren't going in there. And so God said, you can go up on Mount Nebo and look into the land. But you are not physically going to cross the River Jordan and be a part of it. A great lesson for all of us as far as, we want to finish and we want to end up in the land of promise. So this is front on the top of Mount Nebo. And you can see this little chart here. And it talks about if you look off in this direction, you're going to be looking in the direction of Hebron. If you look in this direction here, which would be straight across, you're going to see Jericho. You have different places that it looks at that you can see from Mount Nebo. So Moses could see into the land. He could see across the River Jordan and see from that height the land that they were going into. He could see all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. So these people were quite frightened. They were very worried about what was going to take place. And they were unsure as to what was going to happen. They didn't have any reason to worry, but that's not how they looked at it. So let's go to chapter 22 and look at verse 2. So we looked at verse 1, and it talks about them coming up to the border of the land and getting ready to enter into the land. And it says, now Balak, the son of Zippor, saw that all that Israel had done to the Amorites. So they saw that these two great kings had been defeated. Not only were they aware that they had defeated these two kings, but they had heard that 40 years ago they had left Egypt. And the land of Egypt had been destroyed. They knew that. And they had heard about the king of Arad being wiped out by the Israelites. They had heard about Israel traveling through the wilderness and God being with them and the great things that had been done. So they were afraid. They were afraid of these people. As it says let's look at verses 3 and 4. It says, and Moab was exceedingly afraid of the people because they were many. And Moab was sick with dread because of the children of Israel. So they were, uh, they were the children of Israel coming into the land caused them great fear, and they were sick with dread. It says they were sick, nauseous. They feared these people were going to destroy their nation, and so that they were very scared. They were wondering what was going to happen here, and really they didn't realize this, but they had nothing to fear because God has said, "Don't mess with the people of Moab. Don't bother them. Leave them alone." But they didn't know that. Verse 4 tells us that Balak, they said that now this company will lick up everything around us as an ox licks up the grass of the field. So they looked at these people coming into their land, and basically they're going to wipe out their crops. They're going to take all of their herds and their cattle, and they're going to have nothing left. They're going to be completely decimated by this nation coming into their land. They would have nothing left. They would leave them destitute. And as I said, they didn't have anything to fear. They didn't have anything to fear because Israel had not gone into the land yet. And at this point, where all of this fear is found in Moab, God was still feeding Israel 6 days a week with manna. So he was giving them manna every day while they were east of the Jordan, and twice as much on Friday. And there was no reason for Moab to fear economic devastation. We see human nature at work here. And you really, if Balak, the son of Zippor, had gone out and talked to Moses, they could have resolved this. He could have said, "We're not going to take your land. We're not going to drink from your wells. We're not going to take anything from you. Our goal is across the river. And God has told us to leave you alone." But they did not accept that, and so they chose another course in order to deal with this. Verse 5. Then he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, "Look, a people has come from Egypt. See, they cover the face of the earth and are settling next to me." So he's very worried about this. They've entered his land, and he sends to Balaam, the son of Beor. Now, if you look at a lot of maps, they will show Beth Peor as being right there on the plains of Moab. But that's not accurate. As it says here in the verse 5, it says, "Then he sent messengers to Balaam the son of Beor at Pethor, which is near the river." What river is that? It's not the Jordan River. It's the river, the Euphrates River. So this Balaam's headquarters was in Pethor, up by the Euphrates River. So there gets a delegation together. They're going to go to Balaam and ask him to come down to where they live. Verse 6, it says, "Therefore, please come at once. Curse this people for me, for they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." So the Moabites, because they had been dominated by the Amorites, really didn't have much of an army. And they needed, if they were going to have an army, they needed that army immediately. But being dominated, they didn't have that. They had no recourse to arms. So they're seeking another alternative, which is to ask for this people to be cursed. And obviously Balaam had a reputation that if he blesses somebody, they're blessed. And if they're cursed, they're cursed. And being several hundred miles away, Balak was aware of this. So so Balaam, and as you look at the name Balaam means devourer. It means devourer, or the devourer of the people. And it's a very negative, destructive name. It's also interesting if you look at what Balak means. Balak means devastator. So we have Balak, the devastator seeking to speak with Balaam, the devourer of the people. And then Balaam was the son of Beor, and Beor means burning. All of these names are negative and destructive. I'm sure they were to inspire fear in whoever heard them. It says that Balaam lived at Pethor, which is about 400 miles to the north of Moab, on the banks of the Euphrates River. It's 12 miles south of Carchemish. So another slide here. And so Pethor is going to be in this area here. Here's Carchemish right here. And here's the city of Haran. And as you'll see in a minute, that's important. So Pethor is up here on the Euphrates River. Carchemish is famous, and Haran, both of them are famous, as we'll see. This Carchemish is famous because of a couple of great battles that took place, battles that basically decided the direction that history was going to take. If you remember back to the time of King Josiah, King Josiah was allied with the Babylonians. The Egyptians were allied with the Assyrians. The Babylonians are seeking to throw off the yoke of the Assyrians. And Josiah has thrown in his lot with the Babylonians because he sees it as a way that Judah can be free. So so Pharaoh Necho is coming up here along the coast from Egypt. And Josiah gathers his army and comes out to try to defeat or stop Pharaoh Necho. So the Pharaoh Necho, if you remember the story, said, "Hey, look, this isn't your fight. Stay out of it. Don't do anything that's going to cause us to... this is just not your business." But Josiah was bound and determined, so they met on the plains of Megiddo here, and Judah was defeated, and Josiah was killed. A stray arrow caught him. He was taken from the battlefield, and he died. And so then Pharaoh Necho goes on up here to Carchemish, and what's happened is because Josiah delayed Pharaoh Necho, then by the time Necho gets up here to Carchemish, the Babylonians have besieged the city of Haran. Haran has fallen to the Babylonians, and the Assyrians are having to move back to Carchemish. All right, so that consequence did take place there, where the Babylonians defeated the Assyrians probably near Haran, and the Assyrians have had to retreat. So what's famous about Haran? Well, Haran was the place that Abraham lived for a while. After they left Ur of the Chaldees, they went from Ur up to Haran, Abraham accompanying his father and family there. When Terah died, then Abraham moved on to the land of promise, to the land of Canaan. And later on, in 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar came up against the Assyrians and the Egyptians again at Carchemish. So they had a battle here once again in 605, and Babylon defeated the Assyrians in Egypt. And as a result of that, then Babylon was the dominant force in the world at that time. So the Assyrians are out of the picture, the Egyptians have been defeated, and Nebuchadnezzar, at the head of the Babylonian Empire, is able to move southward and defeat all comers at that point. And as you look at Balaam, Balaam lived just a stone's throw from where all of this was unfolding. He lived just a stone's throw from Haran, actually. And interestingly, there is a connection between Balaam and Abraham. And you may say, well, why was that? Well, because of Haran. That's where Abraham was from. And Haran is about 50 miles away. And the place that Balaam lived, Pethor, was known for its Baru, B-A-R-U. They were priest diviners, and that particular city was known for that. It was an area that was well known for its sorcerers, its magicians, its diviners, its soothsayers, and such. And it is believed that Balaam was from a long line of celebrated soothsayers or diviners. So this was his business. This is his business. He and his family had made their living for several generations cursing or blessing other people. Probably if you drive along the highway from time to time, you'll see signs up for psychic reading. Same kind of thing. You can stop in there and they'll read the tea leaves or tarot cards or whatever tell you what your future is or whatever it may be. Balaam's family had a reputation and it had become widespread. Obviously, it was something that was known because as you come down here to the plains of Moab over here, you know, they knew about it, and it's 400 miles away. It is so we have the family, regardless of the requester's religion or political stripe, if you paid them, they would bless or they would curse. It wasn't about the God, it was about the money. So who's your God? I really don't care. What do you want me to do? And so if we put the cash on the barrel head, we'll take care of it for you. So Balak was wanted him to do this, and Balaam was more than willing to do this because of his desire for the money. What Balak was doing was sending for the most renowned curser in the known world. He wanted Balaam to come down and curse Israel. And Balak had heard about all the things that God had done for Israel. And he needed the very best because he was going up against the God who was able to part the Red Sea. He was going against a God who had devastated the nation of Egypt. He was going up against a God who was able to rain down food from heaven 6 days a week. He was a God who was able to provide water for 2.5 to 3 million people in the desert and who could destroy great kings, the great kings Og and Sion. And Balak needed the very best, and he was willing to give up just about all of his wealth in order to do that. So what have we learned about Balaam? Well, he was internationally renowned. He was seen as the best soothsayer in the known world, and his services were probably expensive. You weren't going to get him on the cheap. And he was probably from a family of soothsayers who specialized in blessings and cursings. And he was probably well-read and knowledgeable in all the methods of cursing and blessing. He was familiar with gods and goddesses of the world. And I'm sure that he knew all about what was going on, especially with Israel. I'm sure word had gotten to him that Israel had come into the plains of Moab. And I'm sure that he had heard of the downfall of Og and Sion. And I'm sure he wanted to, you know, had his ear to the ground, wanted to know what Israel was doing. Who were they defeating? What were their plans? And wanting to know all of those kinds of things. He was, as I said, he was probably a Baru, a priest, a diviner of Mesopotamia who worked enchantments and auguries and sorceries and any kind of a divining that was necessary. And as I said, if you had the money, he would do what you wanted him to do. And interestingly, the tie-in between Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is this. He probably knew something about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He had at least heard things about them from the local history in Haran. You know, Abraham's family had lived there for a while. And Abraham was quite an important individual in his time. Abraham was a direct descendant of Shem. You know, Shem, Ham, and Japheth of the Noachian flood fame. It wasn't that long after the flood. You have to realize Abraham had led an army who had defeated the kings that had come down and taken Lot and others prisoner. These were important kings that he defeated, and that information would have been passed on. This is no small individual. He was a considerable person in his time. Abraham had given up a great deal to follow God's call, and it came through that area where Balaam and his family lived. And it's not out of the realm of possibility that he had a great deal of information about Israel, their origins, their beginnings, and even knew something about what they believed. The people that Abraham and his descendants, as far as wives, where did the wives come from? They'd come from the area of Haran. And so you have Isaac, and where does his wife come from? That same area. Same thing with Jacob. All of them came from this area up around Haran, so there was a tie-in there, and he probably knew something about that. Balaam would have had a considerable interest in them from a local history standpoint, and he certainly knew about Israel and about Israel's God and about the miraculous things that he could do. And this is common knowledge. This was common knowledge at the time. Let's go to the book of Joshua, chapter 2, and look at that for a moment. And it just gives us an indication of how far the information about Israel had spread. Joshua, chapter 2. And let's look at verse 8. And this is they have gone into the land. The spies have gone into the land, and they're scouting things out, and they come to the city of Jericho. And verse 8, it says in chapter 2, verse 8 of Joshua, "Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, 'I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea.'" And this is 40 years before this ever took place. 40 years before this event. This was a lasting understanding of the miracle that God had performed. They knew that this was true. They had heard about what had taken place, and now here are these people on their doorstep. And this God has been with them these last 40 years, and he's still with them, as noted from the defeat of the kings. So she says, we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you, and you came out of the Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, he is the God in heaven, above and on earth beneath. So this is Rahab speaking, and Rahab has taken note of what this God has done. Now, she doesn't know all about the commandments, and she doesn't know all about the details of this people and their gods and God's statutes and judgments. She doesn't know any of that. But she does have enough foresight to see this God is a powerful God, and this God has defeated the kings on the other side. I think he's going to defeat the kings on this side of the Jordan as well. So she had faith. Doesn't mean she was walking in faith every day, but she had enough faith to believe that this God was going to be with Israel and that Israel was going to defeat the people of Canaan. And so she was going to act accordingly. So she was acting in faith. Before we go on, let's look at what the rest of the Bible has to say about Balaam, because the Bible does mention him in both the Old and New Testaments. And the rest of the Bible, when it mentions Balaam, it's not kind to him. It doesn't see him in glowing terms. Let's go to, first of all, to Deuteronomy chapter 23. Deuteronomy chapter 23, and we'll begin in verse 3. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 3. It says, "An Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter the assembly of the Lord. Even to the tenth generation, none of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord forever." Now, why can't they enter? Why did God make this decision? Is it he just didn't like Ammonites or Moabites? God explains why. That they were not to enter the assembly of the Lord. It says in verse 4, because they did not meet you with bread and water on the road when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. They hired this man to curse you. And verse 5, nevertheless, the Lord your God would not listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loves you. So Balaam desired to curse Israel. And God said, you're not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to allow you to do that. And we'll see more about this. But we see here clearly God was not going to listen to Balaam. And so Balaam here is clearly considered an enemy of Israel. Let's go to Joshua chapter 13. So Balaam was able to influence Israel to bring a curse on itself through sin. They sinned, and as a result of that, they were cursed. It wasn't Balaam pronouncing the curse, but he was able to influence the situation so that Israel brought a curse on itself. Joshua chapter 13, verse 22. What was the outcome? What happened to Balaam? Joshua 13, verse 22. The children of Israel also killed with the sword Balaam, the son of Beor, the soothsayer, among those who were killed. So Balaam was ultimately killed by the people of Israel. That was his ultimate fate. He died at the hands of the Israeli army. The Israel took revenge on Balaam because I'm sure they were aware of the impact of Balaam on all of them. Chapter 24, verses 9 and 10. Joshua chapter 24, verses 9 and 10. It says, then Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, arose to make war against Israel and sent and called Balaam, the son of Beor, to curse you. But I would not listen to Balaam. Therefore, he continued to bless you, so I delivered you out of his hand. So he comes up to curse you. I would not allow him to curse you. In fact, what does Balaam end up doing? Blessing Israel. And Balak is standing there as he's blessing Israel, and he's thinking, I paid you big money to curse these guys. What are you doing? But you see, God was influencing Balaam through the Spirit of God, and he was not really in control of what he had to say. So God considers this experience, this deliverance, this salvation for the children of Israel, and it's interesting to think of it that way. Especially due to the fact that 24,000 of the children of Israel died in that deliverance as a result of their sin. 24,000 died. And we have to keep that in the back of our mind as we consider this. So let's look at what the New Testament has to say about this man. Let's go to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2, and let's look at verses 15 and 16. It says, they have forsaken the right way and gone astray. So there were people in the church who had forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he was rebuked for his iniquity, a dumb donkey speaking with a man's voice, restrained the madness of the prophet. So we see here it talks about Balaam, and it says that he loved the wages of unrighteousness. And in Peter's estimation, Balaam was mad. Balaam was mad, insane. He wasn't in his right mind. The madness of the prophet. And he was about the money, The money was the paramount thing. The money, the honor that would come his way. Jude 11. Jude, right before the book of Revelation, also comments on this man. Jude, verse 11. It says, "Woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah." So it ties three individuals who definitely have negative reputations. Cain, he was an evil man in his time. You have Balaam, and you also have Korah. Korah, who led a rebellion against Moses, sought to overthrow him. These are all mentioned there in verse 11. And as I said, they run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit. So that was Balaam's chief goal, was profit. Revelation chapter 2. Final scripture we'll look at here. Revelation chapter 2. Verse 14. And this is speaking about the church. This is speaking about the church, one of the seven churches of the book of Revelation. It's speaking about the church in Pergamos, and it says in beginning in verse 14, it says, "But I have a few things against you," that is, the congregation in Pergamos, "because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit sexual immorality." So Balaam had a certain view of religion, a certain approach to religion. And he said, this very attitude and mindset is in the church. It's in the church. So we have to recognize that in all probability, if it was in the church then, we can also find it in the church now, and it's something to be to consider. And so Balaam's error, his way, it was actually found in the church. It's something that we should be wary of. And the two things that he brings out are idolatry and adultery. They're two sides of the same coin. So we find that Balaam was covetous of wealth and power. He was a practitioner of occult art. He was personally sinful. He led others into sin. Not only did he sin, but he led others into sin. And it appears that, as Peter said, he was not quite sane. A simple reading of this would make you think that Balaam was all right if you didn't look at it carefully. But let's not think, we don't want to think simply. We want to think about this and see the picture that the Bible paints. And it is a picture of a very evil man, a very wicked man. And we might look at this a little bit cynically. Let's go back to Numbers chapter 22. Numbers chapter 22. Numbers 22, and let's begin in verse 7. "So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the diviner's fee in their hand, and they came to Balaam and spoke to him the words of Balak." So they were given a certain amount of money that was the common fee for what they were asking Balaam to do, and they headed up toward Pethor to seal the deal. And so the princes come to Balaam, and let's just go on and finish reading the section here down to verse 14. It says, "And he said to them, 'Lodge here tonight, and I will bring back word to you as the Lord speaks to me.' So the princes of Moab stayed with Balaam. Then God came to Balaam and said, 'Who are these men with you?' So Balaam said to God, 'Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent to me saying, Look, a people has come out of Egypt, and they cover the face of the earth. Come now, curse them for me. Perhaps I shall be able to overpower them and drive them out.' And God said to Balaam, 'You shall not curse. You shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed.' So Balaam rose in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, "Go back to your land, for the Lord has refused to give me permission to go with you." And the princes of Moab rose and went back to Balak and said, "Balaam refuses to come with us." So let's think about this here for a second. The princes come to Balaam and they tell him what Balak has asked. And then when Balaam goes to God, he leaves out some of what the princes said. He doesn't relay to God exactly what the princes said. And after God gives his answer, Balaam reports back to the princes, and this time leaving out some of what God said. He didn't tell them everything. Finally, when the men return to Balak, all they say is, "He's not coming." So, as you look at what's transpiring here, there's a lot of deception in trying to hide the communication between the different parties. The princes certainly didn't want to make Balak mad. I mean, he's called the devastator, so they may be devastated if they make him mad, and because they didn't succeed in their mission. And Balaam didn't want to tell them everything, because what did Balaam want? He wanted them to come back. It didn't bother him that they left. They don't have any, they've got nothing in their arsenal to deal with the Israelites. They need him. He recognizes they need him. And he wants them to come back and offer him more money. So this is called, in a modern parlance, negotiation. All right. So he's negotiating the deal. So, Balaam's in it for the money. He's a sorcerer for hire. And he is negotiating a better deal. So now the first thing that Balaam did wrong right off the bat, what was the first thing he did wrong immediately? He should have said, "I'm not doing that. You guys need to hit the road." I'm sure he knew that God was with the people of Israel. And if he didn't know it before, you know, as he had heard what Israel had done, the different people that had been defeated, and what had happened to Egypt, he certainly knew after God spoke to him directly. Wow. There's a God being that just spoke with me and said, "Don't go with them." So he had to know that. And, if he was truly following God, he would have said, "I'm not even going to consider your offer. I'm not going to go with you. I'm not going to be involved in this at all." Like it says, let's go, just keep your finger there in Numbers and go back to 2 John chapter, 2 John verse 10. 2 John verse 10. Verse 10 says, "If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine," you know, they don't bring the true doctrine as they come, "do not receive him into your house nor greet him, for he who greets him shares in his evil deeds." So for you to welcome in this person that does not bring the truth, the true doctrine, and to welcome them and entertain them and all of that, you're sharing in their evil deeds. And that's exactly what was taking place here. Right off the bat, Balaam has already become complicit in the sins of Balak. And he should have said, "I'm not going to curse Israel. But he doesn't do that because there's a bigger, he wants something. And if he says no, what he wants, he's not going to get. And I'm sure he's looking at a big payday. Let's think about this. Have people that are negotiating a deal ever done unethical things in order to make the deal? I know that probably never happens, but occasionally it does happen in this world. And the reason that they're willing to do unethical things is because it's going to be lucrative to them. And this is the same mindset we find here with Balaam. I'm almost positive from my own reading of this that Balaam didn't expect God to say a word. He was just playing along. I mean, as you look at psychic readers and things, they're going to do their mumbo jumbo and try to sell you on the fact that they can see into the future, what they're clairvoyant or whatever it may be. And there have been lots of charlatans who've taken this approach. However, when you look at what took place here, I don't think he really believed that God was going to talk to him. He was just going to play along for his own advantage. He's putting on the diviner's hat and doing a little acting and saying, you know, I'm going to have to go to God and talk to him about it. Because God and I are like this, and God will certainly communicate with me. So he was playing a charlatan, and it doesn't mention anything about a demon being involved here, but he's going and seeking to play this along. So he was giving them his pitch. Then God surprises him, I think, because he talked to him. He didn't expect God to talk to him. I mean, all of us, if we're praying to God and all of a sudden we heard a voice, would any of you be surprised? I would be. I hope you would be too. Okay, so I'm sure he was surprised. So God started off by asking him, who are these men with you? And making Balaam explain himself. So Balaam does. Then Balaam makes his pitch to God. God, let me curse them. Let me pronounce this curse on them. And God says, no way. He says, you shall not go with them. You shall not curse them. Because I have blessed them. These are my people, and I have blessed them. And Balaam says to Balak's princes, go back to your land. The Lord refused to give me permission. And Balaam actually did what God said here and sent them away with the diviner's fee in their hand. But I'm sure that he was, man, I let that get away. And I hope they come back because I certainly want that fee, but I hope it works out for me to get a bigger bag of gold. So, remember all of the authors that we looked at talk about Balaam as being greedy for profit. And he was willing to curse Israel to make that profit. So what did other Bible writers see from these verses? God obviously approved because he inspired what they wrote. And that's the way that Balaam worked. He was negotiating a higher fee. So let's go back to Numbers chapter 22 and look at verse 15. Verse 15 says, then Balak again sent princes more numerous and more honorable than they. So Balak says, well, he turned us down. We'll send more important princes. Maybe he sent his heir, the future king of Moab, which is an honor for Balaam, and I'm sure they upped the ante as far as what they would offer. Verse 17, for I will certainly honor you greatly, and I will do whatever you say to me. Therefore, please come, curse this people for me. So he wanted them to curse them. You can feel that there's an intensity in the request for him to curse this people. He's basically saying, I can't fight them with the sword. I need you to fight them through your cursing and very probably evil spirits. Verses 18 and 19. Then Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of gold and silver, I could not go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. I'm not going to be able to go beyond what the limitations that God has put on me. Now, therefore, please, you also stay here tonight that I may know what more the Lord will say to me. And this time, I'm sure he was expecting God to say something to him. God had spoken to him before, so he said, I think God will speak to me. Verses 20 and 21. And God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men come to you to call you, rise and go with them. But only the word which I speak to you, that you shall do. So Balaam rose in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princes of Moab. So the question here is this. So God tells him, he says, if the men come to call you. And that's the critical phrase. If the men come to call you. So God's telling him, listen very carefully what I have to say. And so Balaam, what did Balaam do? He saddled his donkey and he went with the men. And the only part of that, of those verses that he heard was, you know, if they come to you, then you're free to go with them. So God had given him permission to go. The qualifying phrase, if they come to you, is completely neglected. God didn't give him permission to go. It doesn't say anything about them coming to him and requesting that he go with them. He just went with them. So he just went with them. And so how Balaam replies to the embassy of Balak is one of the main themes of this whole account. He says, I can't go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. And he repeats that. That's repeated a number of different times in chapter 22 and 23 and 24. All that the Lord has said, I can do. Go back and tell, go back to Balak, and thus you shall speak. He could only say what God put into his mouth. That's the limitation that God put on him. So if God makes the point that you're limited in what you could say over and over again, this must be important. And he did say it over and over again. But Balaam never got it. He never got it. And how do we know that? Because throughout the entire account, these three chapters, he is trying his best to curse Israel. He is trying this path, that path, whatever he can do to be able to curse Israel. And he's trying every which way to be able to get that done. But he realizes that he's limited. He's limited because God has said, you can't go beyond the limitations I put on you. He keeps being restrained by God. And so why is Balaam unwilling to heed God? Because he wants the honor and he wants the money. He wants the pot of gold. And God spoke to him time and time again, and he appears to him visibly as the angel of the Lord, and he speaks to him through a donkey. Probably most of us would find that, I don't usually see that, and we probably would have thought, maybe God's trying to get my attention. But God keeps changing Balaam's words in his mouth, speaking blessings and not curses. And God puts his spirit on him and he prophesies under the inspiration of the Spirit of God. And still Balaam is trying to do his own will, not God's will. And Balaam never got God's simple command, say the words that I put in your mouth and no more. And why didn't he get it? Because he was driven by the desire for gold, by pride, and who knows what else. And so Balaam had a certain mindset here, and it's called the way of Balaam. So we built up to the way of Balaam, and we're not going to reveal what that is until next month. So all of you can think about what the way of Balaam is, and we'll talk about that next time.